seven every day fighting in this thing. It's like a great fight, the intensity. Don Jr. had spent the 24 years before his father threw his hat in the ring, going from one great fight to the next. When Barbara Walters asked Donald who his most challenging kid was, he barely took half a breath before responding, "Don." The fact that Don Jr. was the only one of his kids who was both old and strong-willed enough to confront his father after the Marla incident played out in Aspen and he moved out of the triplex undoubtedly factored into Donald's answer. It was Donnie who shouted at him that he didn't care about his kids and that the only thing that mattered to him was money. But Don Jr. had a sixth sense for sniffing out when someone was spoiling for a fight, and he would jump right in their path once he found them. He'd pester his father to find out when he was coming home from work, Donald wrote in The Art of the Deal. "I tell Donnie I'll be home as soon as I can, but he insists on a time," Donald wrote. "Perhaps he's got my genes. The kid won't take no for an answer." In the height of the mayhem surrounding his parents' divorce when paparazzi were following him to school, he beat up two boys in his Buckley class when they sniggered about the headlines about his father's affair and his sex life with Marla. He rarely shied away from drunken skirmishes and pissing contests at Penn, and that urge didn't lessen with age. A few days shy of his 25th birthday, Don Jr. sat at a table with two women close to the stage at the Comedy Cellar, a little club on McDougal Street in Greenwich Village. On weekends, a line snakes around the block, past the holes in the wall just off NYU's campus selling falafel and bongs and booze, with people waiting to head down the few stairs and inside to watch stand-up. It was nearing 2 in the morning when other people around Don Jr. had had enough. He'd been loud and obnoxious and distracting for hours. Three couples had told him to pipe down, according to a New York Post account at the time, but he brushed them off. People at a neighboring table thought Trump was reacting too enthusiastically to a comic's ethnic humor, the Post reported. It escalated from an eye-rolling annoyance to a full-on throwdown once Don Jr. raised his glass and splashed some beer on a woman at a nearby table. It is not clear if it was intentional or an accident, a malicious retaliation or a drunken mistake in the heat of the moment. It didn't much matter to the two men who watched the beer fly out of his glass and onto the woman. "You think that's funny?" one guy bellowed. Before he knew it, the man and another guy he was with had tossed their beer steins at him, which whacked him square in the head, smashing and sliding out of that slicked back hair. Someone called the police, who turned up and took Don Jr. to St. Vincent's Hospital, where doctors closed the gash on his head with 28 stitches. No charges were filed against him. But the two men who hit him with their glasses, 23-year-olds from Staten Island in Brooklyn, were arrested and charged with assault before they were released on $5,000 bail. One of the guy's family members told the Post that their relative was hardly hot-tempered. "He had to have been provoked," he said. "You'd have to push his buttons hard for him to fight back." A longtime friend of the Trump family, who's known Don Jr. since before Donald and Ivana got divorced, always comes back to this story when asked about Don Jr. "I've seen a lot of rough stuff in my life, and I have to tell you, I've never once seen someone break glass over a person's head," he said. "Punching a guy in the nose, pushing him to the ground, okay. Breaking a chair, even. Do you know what kind of a jerk you have to be to get a beer stein broken over your head? That tells you everything you need to know about a kid." Publicly, Donald defended his son. He was blindsided, he said of Don Jr. to the Post. "I'm going to sue their ass off. I'm also going to sue the club for allowing this to happen." The club's owner at the time did not sweat the threat too much. "Maybe I'll countersue Don Jr. for disrupting the club." It wasn't the first time Don Jr. brushed with the law. Less than a year earlier, he traveled to New Orleans for a few days celebrating Mardi Gras. He reveled a bit too hard, perhaps, and on February 25th, 2001, police rounded him up and arrested him on a charge of public drunkenness. The real estate heir, whose parents boasted about telling all of their children every morning before they went to school that they were never allowed to drink or do drugs or get in trouble, and who have repeatedly bragged that their kids actually listened, spent 11 hours behind bars before he was released. The Comedy Cellar incident also wasn't the first time Don Jr. had found himself worse for the wear after a scuffle. He told Esquire in 2012 that he's broken probably every major bone in my body. I currently have in my body 15 pins and a plate. I've broken my femur, both wrists, both ankles, my left ankle twice, my tibia, tore my rotator cuff, and that doesn't include knuckles, noses, and don't get me started. And it wouldn't be the last. A few years later, things blew up between a 28-year-old Don Jr. and a 44-year-old woman who lived at 220 Riverside Boulevard in a 420-unit high-rise on the west side of Manhattan. In the fall of 2006, Eugenia Kay sent a letter to other residents living in the building, alleging that the building's board had misappropriated or misspent $500,000 stemming from a gas bill the building had not paid for 6 months in a row, even though gas was included in the common charges condo owners already paid each month. Her letter also alleged that the building sponsor had yet to pay back $250,000 borrowed from building money without having gotten a green light from the board first. Kay's letter successfully roused her neighbors to vote out 7 board members, including Don Jr. At the time, Don Jr. stayed quiet about the coup, but his father stuck up for him once the Post caught wind of the story. As he did when news of the bar fight went public, he said that his son had been blindsided, this time not by guys with beer steins, but by a woman with extraordinary ambition to be on a board. This go-around, instead of simply threatening legal action, Don Jr. actually filed a $50 million defamation suit against Kay and sought to regain his seat on the condo board. "He's a good kid and a hard worker. He did a very good job on that board," Donald added. Everything came to a head at the building's holiday party by year's end. There are two sides to how the evening unfolded. The way Kay told it at the time, Don Jr. came in steaming mad. He found her, got in her face, and shouted at her, cursing and calling her names. Don Jr. claims it was Kay who lost control, punching the property manager in the face in front of her neighbors. "Welcome to real estate in New York City," Donald told the Post in response. Don Jr.'s attack dog instincts manifested themselves more literally. Friends have nicknamed him the Fifth Avenue Redneck because of his proclivity for spending weekends and vacations fly fishing in Alaska, moose hunting in the Canadian bush, and prairie dog shooting in Montana. He started hunting with his grandfather during the summers he spent in Czechoslovakia, away from his parents and the trappings of the triplex on Fifth, and picked it up again once he moved to central Pennsylvania after Donald and Ivana split to board at the Hill School. He started small, clay shooting at a rifle range on campus, and then began meeting other guys around town to fly fish, venturing out into the cold all bundled up to meet guys at 6 o'clock in parking lots near campus. "I just got hooked, and then I basically read everything there was to read about all the different forms of hunting. I just got so into it. I read every book available. I spoke to whoever would listen to me. I went with whoever would take me," he said in an interview with the online hunting publication Bowsight during the campaign. That was part of the reason why Don Jr. picked up and moved to Colorado after he graduated from Wharton. "I was probably the first graduate of the Wharton School of Finance to go be a bartender," he told Bowsight of his decision to live in Aspen for a year after he graduated. Donald and Ivana fumed once he made the choice. His father offered him a job in the Trump Organization. Ivana told him she would give him no money if he wasted his life away as a ski bum booze hound in the middle of the woods. He turned his dad down and turned his chin up at his mom and defied them both anyway. He wanted to make sure he knew what he was getting into before entering the family business and the craziness associated there with it, he told people. He didn't want any regrets, he'd say, before settling into a life the beats of which he could plot out with his eyes closed. Plus, he was still chilly with his father, who'd just settled his divorce with Marla a year earlier and started dating Melania. And he had a lot of drinking left to do before going to work 15 hours a day with his teetotaling, hot-tempered, impossible-to-please old man. So he left it all behind for a while and rented a little place in Aspen on Roaring Fork Drive from a local family. It was just a mile away from the Little Nell, the hotel where he and his siblings had stayed with his parents on holidays when he was growing up, but it was a world away in most respects. He tended bar at the Tippler, an après-ski bar at the base of Aspen Mountain that they opened at the western edge of the Little Nell ski run. Locals called it the Crippler, the kind of place where vacationers and locals alike soaked their altitude-sick livers in booze and picked up equally as wasted singles for the night. People could come in full snowsuits and spill out onto the enclosed sun deck, other times or dressed up, cozying into the maroon-upholstered couches or around the built-in backgammon tables. Certainly, the crowd orbited around the oval-shaped bar where, for a year, Don Jr. helped them all get drunk. He did his fair share of drinking himself, but hunting helped him cut down a bit. Hunting has been a great, great value in my life, and probably kept me out of a lot of other trouble I would have otherwise gotten into, he told Beausite. I think when you're waking up at 4 a.m. in the morning to get into a deer blind or to, you know, get in a stand or to go waterfowl hunting, whatever it may be, it was a lot harder to be up at 3 in the morning from the night before, and so I owe the outdoors. In Colorado, he'd go out with friends he made, former members of the U.S. ski team in far better shape than he was, who were fairly skilled bow hunters. Don knew he was at the end of his rope in Aspen by the time the three guys went out on public land to hunt elk during the month of August. His bank account was running thin, and there would be a time where his father perhaps wouldn't keep an office open for him in Trump Tower, not if he defied him for too long. As he tells it, his brain was starting to atrophy, and he was ready for something more. But there was time for one last go at it. He and his buddies spent weeks chasing the things with no luck. They had 2 days left of the season, 2 days left before Don Jr. decided he was going to pack up and head back to New York and resign himself to being the Trump heir everyone expected him to be, when they saw hoofs through the bushes below them. They were on such a steep slope that they couldn't move up or down when the elk came into view, rounding a bend of brush 7 yards in front of them. It was just incredible, Don Jr. told Beausite. I mean, there's not many more intense experiences than that. It did get more intense. He and Eric often went on hunting trips together, including for Eric's bachelor party. Better than a no-win trip to Vegas, Don Jr. later said, adding that he brought his young son along for the 7-mile hike with a bunch of his friends who'd never hunted before. It was not exactly Mar-a-Lago or the night out doing karaoke at Chelsea Piers that Ivanka chose for her bachelorette party years earlier. They hadn't told Donald they were going on a week-long hunting trip so far into the bush that it took days to get to the kill spot. Don Jr. had been hunting seriously for more than a decade by this point, but he had a mishap. His scope hit him smack in the head and sliced into his forehead like a hot knife into butter, nearly straight through to the bones in his skull. They were too far away from any kind of civilization for him to even get to a doctor who could stitch him up, even if he wanted to. He couldn't call Donald because they were too far out of range, and Donald didn't know where they were anyhow. So he dug into his kit and pulled out the crazy glue that had languished there during his many trips. He glued the pieces of his flesh back together before they continued on, leaving a little line in the middle of his face that plastic surgeons back home would have undoubtedly easily avoided. It would have been just as easy to avoid the public relations nightmare and blistering backlash Don Jr. and Eric got in 2012, when photos of a hunt they'd gone on in Zimbabwe 2 years earlier surfaced online. There was a grinning Don Jr. in a loose green jacket, dirt-stained khakis held up by a tactical belt filled with unused ammunition that would eventually end up in other wildlife, mud-caked boots, and a backward camo cap containing his jet-black hair. He leaned up against the lifeless big black buffalo he'd just shot dead, his rifle in his left hand, his right arm resting against the buffalo's horns. In another shot, Don Jr. held up a knife in one hand and the tail of an elephant he'd just killed, pink and gory at its root, where he'd sliced it off the animal's body. Don's own palms were covered in blood, His hair slicked back in the same 1980s Wall Street banker style he favored throughout his father's presidential campaign. There was another in which he and Eric, in matching khakis and toothy smirks, posed with a giant cheetah, not unlike the enormous plush F.A.O. Schwarz stuffed animals their little brother Baron posed with soon after he was born for a magazine spread shot in his Fifth Avenue nursery. This cheetah was real, though, and now it was dead, hanging over Eric's arm after they'd killed it a little while earlier. Eric himself posed for photos with his rifles and the kudu and buffalo he killed. In one photo, taken by the light of a raging fire, he sits on a dead buffalo he's shot like a chair, shaggy blonde hair falling, half-smiling like an Abercrombie model. He'd leaned three guns against its body and hung his hat on one of its horns. It was evident from the word go that these two amazing young men are everything but the city slickers you would expect, their tour guide wrote of the two men when the photos went public. The vast majority of reactions were decidedly more negative. It was a code red for PETA and wildlife advocates. The Apprentice almost immediately lost one of its advertisers. The chief executive of Camping World told TMZ that its ad had already aired on NBC during an episode of that season of Donald's reality show, but he wouldn't spend another nickel with them after the photos came to light. Even some of their friends, who were all well aware of their hunting, couldn't believe the tastelessness of the photos. That they would kill these animals was perhaps callous, but it was part of who they were. That they would pose with them so gleefully seemed less defensible. And that they'd do so knowing the possible press these photos could receive, coming from the Trump family media genes, was inexcusable. Donald did try to defend the photos and his sons. They're hunters, and they've become good at it, he told TMZ at the time. I am not a believer in hunting, and I'm surprised they like it. Donald banned Don and Eric from doing interviews about their hunting until the campaign, when advisors repeatedly told him that they were in a perfect moment in which surrogates who could actually speak with authority on the Second Amendment would really help him in the race. In the early days of the campaign, the base was terrified that Obama was going to take away all their guns, so we thought it was a perfect time for Don Jr. to do outreach, one advisor remembered. Don Jr. didn't need his dad's tepid response when the photos surfaced. He attacked the critics far harder this time on his own. I'm not going to apologize because some eco-nuts want me to, he wrote in one tweet. I'm not going to run and hide because the PETA crazies don't like me, he tweeted to a critic. I hunt and eat game, he responded to someone else in all caps. He also assured another person on Twitter offended by the photos that it was not wasteful because the villagers were so happy for the meat, which they don't often get to eat. Very grateful. He further defended himself against people who called him and his brother bloodthirsty morons in an interview with Forbes around the same time. Those people did not truly understand hunting, he said, and certainly they did not and could not understand what hunting meant to Don Jr. If you wait through long, cold hours in the November woods with a bow in your hands, hoping a buck will show, or if you spend days walking in the African bush trailing Cape Buffalo while listening to lions roar, you're sure to learn hunting isn't about killing, he explained. Hunting forces a person to endure, to master themselves, even to truly get to know the wild environment. Actually, along the way, hunting and fishing makes you fall in love with the natural world. For all the spoils and privileges and riches and comforts and opportunities and open gilded doors dealt to Don Jr., he'd gotten some pretty rotten cards too. He was a poor little rich boy in the most classic sense. In some ways, particularly in his childhood and early adolescence, life had beaten him down. It makes sense, then, that he would grow up feeling as though he needed to always be swinging back. Hunting gave him an outlet in which to do that. Don Jr. had so many abnormal things, but he lacked the normal securities and unconditional support systems normal children grow up without even knowing they have. Those things he lacked, he found in the sport. First, it let him be anonymous, which was something life alongside his famous parents never afforded him as desperately as he wanted it. When I was younger, I was very ardent about being anonymous, he told the New York Post in 2002. I stayed in the background and let my parents do their thing and didn't have a problem with it. I didn't want to get sucked into it. He often talks about how there are men he's hunted with for years who have no idea what his last name is, and when they do find out, they already know him well enough as a normal guy in a hunting vest who knows his way around a rifle that the Trump doesn't much matter. It also was one area in his life in which he felt in control. From elementary to boarding school to Penn, his parents had decided where he would go to school. I had the complete Ivy League resume coming out of high school, he told Esquire. I had the grades, I had the boards, I played varsity sports, I was the editor of our school newspaper, the yearbook, the literary magazine, but I thought maybe I should go to the University of Colorado out in Boulder or to the University of Vermont and ski. But his dad thought otherwise when Don Jr. suggested that maybe Donald's alma mater was not the right place for him. Listen, don't be a schmuck, he said. So Don Jr. went, majoring in finance and marketing at Wharton, as his dad had before him. His parents decided it was a bad decision to move to Aspen after college. They decided where it would be appropriate for him to work, how to work, where to vacation, and later, who to marry. Out in the middle of nowhere, he called the shots, quite literally. It was an area his father had no expertise or interest in, so it belonged to him. For the first time in his life, he'd found a place where he was the boss and without a dad who everyone thought knew better breathing down his neck. The need hole that hunting filled most was the gaping opening left by Donald. His father, much like his father before him, had spent time with Don Jr. as a child only on his terms. Donald's children would come to his office and play on his floor while he worked, until he shooed them off up the private elevator from Trump Tower's 26th floor to the triplex 40 floors up. If they wanted to see him on the weekends, they'd tour construction sites with him, though they did come to love that part for themselves. If they went on trips, they were to properties his dad owned, which meant they weren't actually vacations so much as extended business. A longtime associate of Donald's remembers joining Donald and a reporter from the New York Times Los Angeles Bureau who was working on a story about the Trump Organization and its press-courting boss for a dinner at the Atlantic City casino he owned. It was the mid-1990s, not too long after the divorce between Donald and Ivana had been settled, and Don Jr. was down there working at the Trump Marina to make spare cash. His dad insisted he come for the meal, meaning he had to sit through the tedious show his father put on for the reporter, the same braggadocio he'd likely heard a million times. He was still angry with his dad over the divorce, and he was a teenager. It was the last place Don Jr. could ever want to be on a weekend evening. He sat sullen and silent throughout their meal, rarely engaging, mostly because his father rarely acknowledged that he was even at the table, the associate remembered. Donald turned on the charm when another 13-year-old boy approached their table. It was his birthday, and his parents had given him the option of doing anything to celebrate. A trip to Disney World, a meal at any restaurant he could dream up, but he wanted to go to the Taj Mahal just in case Donald Trump was in town. Donald was delighted and warned the boy and his family not to go to the casino. The only person who makes money in the casino is the person who owns it. Him, he told them, so if I were you, I wouldn't go down there. The family smiled sheepishly, got a photo, and slunk away. After the meal, Donald insisted on walking through the casino floor with the reporter and his associate, knowing Don Jr. wasn't old enough to go along with them. So he sent his son down a separate staircase. We never saw him again the rest of the night, the associate remembered. I had to ask Donald if he wanted to make sure he got back okay. He'll be fine, he told me. Don Jr.'s grandfather, Dedo, stepped in to fill the empty space first. By the time he was in kindergarten, Dedo would send him off into the woods for hours on end. Don Jr. would go alone or with Eric once he was old enough, But he knew that his grandfather was doing it for his own good and would be there at the wood's edge waiting for him to return. He also knew that he would meet other boys his age playing outside, boys who grew up a world away from the mansions and private schools and jets with his last name boldly printed on their wings, kids who instead lived in then-communist Czechoslovakia who couldn't even imagine the wealth Don Jr. took for granted. "I really learned what it was like to see the other side," Don Jr. told an audience at the Western Hunting and Conservation Expo decades later, during his father's presidential campaign. "The more and more I went back and had friends there, I learned that everything in life didn't have to do with material goods. It was about relationships." One of those relationships was forged years later, once he arrived in Pottstown, Pennsylvania to attend the Hill School. The dean of students on campus, who happened to be an expert shot, took a liking to Don Jr., who he soon found out, rather unexpectedly, had spent as much time as he had with his grandfather learning how to shoot a bow and handle a gun and survive for hours in the outdoors without security or maids or limos catering to him. He'd rouse him at 6 in the morning and bring him to meet his hunting buddies in town. "From that point on, I just fell in love with the hunting lifestyle," Don Jr. said at the expo. "I fell in love with it. There's been so many guys along the way that have been mentors." That he quickly found out these were guys he could trust played a huge factor in his affinity for the hobby. So many people wanted something from him. His money, his family's fame and access, his business. And his parents had taught him from a young age that, because of that, there was no one whose intentions he could rely on, not even his own family. He told host Donnie Deutsch in a 2008 episode of CNBC's The Big Idea that his father would repeat the same maxims when he'd go down at 7 in the morning before school to give his dad a kiss good morning and a quick hello and goodbye before he started his day. "No smoking, no drinking, no drugs," his dad would tell him. But then he followed up with, "Don't trust anyone ever." And you know, he'd follow it up 2 seconds later with, "So, do you trust me?" And I'd say, "Of course, you're my dad." He'd say, "What did I just..." You know, he thought I was a total failure. He goes, "My son's a loser, I guess, because I couldn't even understand what he meant at the time. I mean, it's not something you tell a 4-year-old, right? But it really means something to him." He knows so many people who have been taken advantage of, whether it's by colleagues, but even by families. But when you're in a duck blind in the middle of nowhere, or you hear hoofsteps after a month of no luck finding elk 2 days before you have to move back to New York, but you're on a slope so steep you can't move, or a scope splits the skin of your forehead when you're too far away from any medical professional to call for help, well, you have to trust who's around you. And mostly, he could. They didn't want anything from him. Something sent them all out there, on a mission, fleeing the day-to-day, seeking camaraderie, searching for peace. Their reasons were all different, and Don's were certainly more unusual than most. Most of the people he hunted with weren't out there escaping anything like what he was escaping. They might not have any window into what led a rich heir who'd grown up in a glass tower covered in marble and gold deep into the bush in muddy hunting boots and ill-fitting khakis. For the most part, many of them didn't even know his last name. "I think it's a distinction between those two lives that gives me the relaxation I need," he told Bosite. "I can step into the woods and out of the office, and it's exactly the opposite of what I've done all week. That's my form of meditation, so to speak." Don Jr.'s form of meditation did come to serve someone other than himself. During the campaign, then-Iowa Governor Terry Branstad invited Donald to his state for a hunting trip. There was no world in which Donald would have agreed to that, no matter how politically expedient it would be. So he called his son and asked him to take the trip in his place. "Don, you can finally do something useful for me," he told his son. In other ways, Don Jr. distanced himself, however slightly, from the narrow world his father occupied. Donald had his sights set on a particular vision of success, a flashy one, in his 20s and 30s. He wanted to be on Fifth Avenue, on the water in Palm Beach, first in the Hamptons and then in Greenwich. He and Ivana went out most nights with people who also lived on Fifth or thereabouts, who wintered in Palm Beach and summered in the Hamptons or in Greenwich, and took private jets or chauffeured cars to get there. Everything was the biggest, the most expensive, the goldest with the most marble, and certainly everything made its way to the press somehow. He was the cartoon version of a rich man in Manhattan, and he'd illustrated the whole thing to make sure his image fit the type to a T. Once he had all these things, he'd know he'd arrived, and thanks to the hungry press he aggressively courted, so would everyone else. That Don Jr. drew his own life in his 20s and 30s in a far less flashy fashion is a function of the fact that he'd grown up among it all. He didn't need to prove anything to anyone. He knew Palm Beach. He knew gold and marble. He knew jets and chauffeurs. Don Jr. arrived simply by being born, and so all these things weren't exciting or novel or symbols of his success. That is not atypical for a second or third generation rich kid, but it was even more pronounced for Don Jr., who had a bit of disdain for the choices his father made in service of his personal wealth and celebrity. So in some ways, Don's young adulthood sent him in a different direction. "I definitely don't have his flamboyance," he said in 2005. "I am very different in my personal life. I mean, I like fly fishing and being outdoors. He likes parties and playing golf, and he doesn't turn the work button off, ever." As for the public attention, he said, "I don't want that. That's his thing, and he's really good at it." To be sure, Don Jr. still lived a life of privilege and leisure and relative ease. His father helped him buy an apartment. He gave him an executive position within a real estate company bearing his name as soon as he returned from his lost year in Aspen, with a college degree and no other work experience than his years as a dockhand in the Trump Marina and what he'd soaked in trailing his father around job sites as a kid. He did fly commercial when he traveled for business, though, unless he was flying with his father. And he almost always flew coach, though sometimes he'd snag a business seat if it wasn't much more expensive or the travel schedule was particularly grueling. "We're too cheap," he told the New York Times in 2007, "and try to save money where we can. I try to upgrade when I can with frequent flyer miles, but that's been getting increasingly difficult." He went through security like the rest of the universe, something he'd avoided in his childhood on his dad's plane in private airports where you walk right on board without so much as a wave to the guys on the tarmac. He told the Times that he'd missed a flight to Boston around the time of the interview because of a mishap with a $20 battery-operated Brookstone alarm clock he'd bought at an airport kiosk a few months earlier. He'd stowed it away in his carry-on and sent it through the X-ray scanner before he made his way through the metal detector. The TSA agent screening his bag thought the clock looked suspicious, and despite the famous last name on his ticket and his insistence that it was just a tiny little travel clock, they shut the security lane down and called in the state police. After a few minutes, they determined that it was, in fact, an alarm clock. Meanwhile, Don Jr. was being held shoeless in the security line, watching the minutes tick closer to his flight departure time. "I felt like an idiot," he told the Times. The plane left without him, since the whole thing took about a half hour. But he did get to keep the alarm clock in the end. "Sometimes it pays to be a Trump," he joked. The Trump Tower triplex he grew up in is 33,000 square feet, though, like many things tied to Donald's material possessions and valuations of his assets, there is some debate over its true size versus Donald's estimation of its vastness. The first apartment he shared with his wife Vanessa was a little more than 1,500 square feet. It had two bedrooms and parquet floors, one room with sky blue walls and one painted deep red, a zebra print rug in the guest room. They didn't have a house cleaner to tidy up after them, at least in the early years, in contrast to the fully staffed household in which he grew up. They filled the apartment with hand-me-down furniture, an antique canopy bed Vanessa's mom had used for two decades, brown leather couches Don used in his bachelor pad. There were sentimental objects Ivana and Donald would never have had in their homes, too. Oil paintings made by Vanessa's Danish grandfather, the childhood teddy bear she'd kept since she was 6 months old, and the Captain Pickle doll Don had hung on to from his childhood. In the kitchen, where he spent a great deal of time, he kept an organized fly fishing collection and a cast iron skillet in which his grandmother Mary had cooked all the Trumps family meals in their Queens home. Don Jr. and Vanessa cooked at home, too. They preferred it to going out. I learned at a young age, in the single digits, 8 or 9 years old, and was into it, he recalled of his love for cooking. He studied the chefs at Mar-a-Lago, learning how to make seafood, curries, Italian stuff that he later started whipping up for his wife. They filled their home with family photos and snapshots of their wedding and photo albums, which he said were all he'd take if the building were to go up in a blaze, and they had to make a quick exit. There wouldn't be a fire, he clarified, because this is a Trump building. In early April of 2018, a fire on the 50th floor of Trump Tower broke out. There were no sprinklers, and one of the residents died in the blaze. Their two little yappy Havanese puppies, Fraggle and Falufa, had the run of the place, and around Christmas time their parents got them a little tree of their own because we're idiots, Don recalls in 2008. He was stingier when it came to presents to his siblings. Look, I've been regifted presents that I've given my family, he admitted the same year. You know, they're like, oh, great, thanks, and then you end up getting it back the next year. As much as Don Jr.'s confrontational affect and his decision to live a lower-key lifestyle were because of and in reaction to his father, they were also, in part, inherited from him. His father passed down other traits, the connection to which are harder to deny. I think they probably got a lot of my father's natural security or ego or whatever, Don told New York Magazine. I can be my own person and not have to live under a shadow. I definitely look up to him in many ways. I'd like to be more like him when it comes to business. But I think I'm such a different person, it's hard to even compare us. His work persona is kind of what he is. I have a work face, and then there's my private life. Portions of Don's private life are perhaps where he and his father align most, and women seem to be a place in which they overlap. His sister spent years distancing herself from fellow blonde New York heiress Paris Hilton, making her club rat image a foil to the squeaky clean, hardworking image Ivanka wanted to project. But Don Jr. was far softer to Hilton. In the early 2000s, Chris Wilson, a rookie Page Six reporter, turned up to a party on the roof of Playboy headquarters on Fifth Avenue. Hilton was there, in a high-low sartorial melange of a belly shirt and a diamond choker, and as the evening progressed, Don Jr. showed up as well, his standard greasy bob looking extra greasy and bob-like for the occasion. Wilson had never met Don Jr. before, though he had met his father a few times, once in Trump's house, which he thought looked like a casino designed by Saddam Hussein. Don Jr. was wasted by the time the three of them somehow ended up sharing a cab to go home. Hilton on one side, Don Jr. on the other, Wilson as a buffer smack in the middle of them. Paris needed one because Jr. continuously arched himself over Wilson to paw at the heiress, trying to rub her exposed belly like a genie who would grant his late-night drunken wish. Paris had no interest, clinging to Wilson and radiating a not-so-subtle help-me signal from all angles of her spray-tanned face. Somehow, the three of them managed to take a photo together, which Page Six was going to run under the caption, "The Art of the Feel." It ultimately got scrapped. Don Jr. had more success with another model, though it took a bit of time. He'd tagged along with his father to a fashion show in 2003 in New York, not exactly his scene, but he obliged. This was a more palatable parental request for the single 26-year-old who'd settled into an executive role at his father's company by then. It was Donald who spotted a leggy, long-haired blonde walking in the show. He approached Vanessa Hayden, a fellow Upper East Side-raised, private school-bred girl coming into the limelight. Donald introduced himself and said he would like her to meet his son, Donald Trump Jr. Before the show began, Don and Vanessa made the uncomfortable small talk that would come from two young people being thrust together with one's father tagging along and prying eyes all around. At intermission, Donald approached Vanessa again, as if the first conversation had never happened at all. Again, he introduced himself and told her that she should meet his son, Donald Trump Jr. "Yeah, we just met," she told him, looking toward Don Jr. as if his dad had lost his mind. Fate, or the intensely small circle that is the 20-something scene on the Upper East Side, depending on your subscription to romantic fantasies, brought the two back together again less than 2 months later at a birthday party at Butter, a downtown restaurant-cum-club that was the place for a New York minute. They found each other and talked for what felt like most of the night before she realized who he was, that she had met him weeks earlier at the fashion show. "Wait," she later recalled saying, "you're the one with a retarded dad." The way the media wrote about Vanessa, the story they created around her, was not unlike the way they described Melania when she first started dating Donald. All sunshine, success, good breeding, and no drama. The whole truth of both women's pasts was initially entirely left out. Just as Melania was described as a college graduate with 2 degrees who grew up with a fashion designer mother and thrived in an impressive modeling career, Vanessa was introduced to the world by The Times and other publications as a woman who grew up in a townhouse and blossomed into a tennis star at the Dwight School, who, with her athletic build, buttery tan, blonde hair, and sunny smile, seems like a Brian Wilson fantasy. She joked and wore jeans and avoided social climbing and signed with the impressive Wilhelmina agency, even though her mother ran a modeling agency of her own. Vanessa Hayden, The Times wrote, was born for the role of becoming a newly minted Trump. And just as it later came to light that Melania had not, in fact, graduated with architecture and design degrees, but instead dropped out after a year, and that her mother had actually been a textile factory worker, Vanessa's fuller past didn't stay in the past for long. For as much as Vanessa might look like a Beach Boys muse, she may have actually been more of a Scorsese chick at her core. Hayden first came into the public consciousness in 1998, when she was spotted lip-locked with Leonardo DiCaprio, who, at the time, was white-hot in a post-Titanic universe at a party in Soho. The pair only dated a few weeks, long enough for gossips to pick up on her saying how the star found dating a down-to-earth girl like her, and her agents to jump on her 15 minutes of famous flingdom by selling modeling photos of Hayden to foreign newspapers. Her romantic dalliances beyond DiCaprio captured headlines and the sharp tongues of those who knew her at Dwight as well. For years, on and off, she dated a man who went by the name Valentine, whom she met as a teenager. Legend had it that Valentine, a member of the Latin Kings who lived in Astoria, was not every Upper East Side mother's dream suitor for her aspiring model daughter. But the topic was catnip for Vanessa's classmates and contemporaries and all of their parents who found out about the relationship. Rumors swirled about her briefly moving into his apartment, about her wearing starter jackets in yellow, a show of support for the Latin King's color, and maybe stopping by a meeting for the Latin Queens. She visited Valentine in Rikers once he got locked up on drugs and weapons charges, though the frequency of her prison visits was a subject of some debate. Her spokesman at the time told the New York Post, which gamely reported on all the rumors after she started dating Don Jr., that she only visited Rikers once, after she and Valentine had already broken up, to translate for his mother, who spoke no English. Her rep also denied she was involved with the Latin Queens or wore yellow in solidarity. She used to be this hard rock in leather and baggy jeans, one teenage friend said of Hayden to New York Magazine in a story about DiCaprio. She was a total gangster bitch. Another friend referred to her as an ill thug. New York also pointed out that in her high school yearbook, her classmates voted her most likely to wind up on Ricky Lake. Don Jr. took a page out of his father's playbook when it came to his proposal. Donald had accepted a hefty discount from Graff Diamonds on Melania's 13-carat sparkler when he proposed in 2004. The jeweler, which also appeared on an episode of The Apprentice, noted an uptick in sales after it ingratiated itself with the Trumps, and Donald bragged to the press about how he'd knocked some money off the price of the rock. And so, when it came time for Don Jr. to pop the question, only 6 months after his dad had asked his third wife to marry him, there was a jeweler willing to foot the bill and a Trump willing to take advantage of it. The difference, of course, was that Donald proposed with the discounted ring in private before the couple walked the red carpet at the annual Met Gala. It was different for Don Jr. After a year and a half of dating, he took his girlfriend to New Jersey. The couple arrived at the Short Hills Mall, where TV crews and paparazzi were waiting. They'd been invited by the real estate heir as part of an agreement he made with the jeweler, Bailey Banks and Biddle. If Don Jr. proposed in front of flashbulbs and agreed to additional promotional appearances on behalf of the jewelry store, then the $100,000, 4-carat, emerald-cut diamond, set in platinum and surrounded by two smaller trapezoid diamonds and 56 others around the ring, would be his for free. So in November 2004, right in the middle of the suburban Jersey Mall, with television cameras rolling, Don Jr. got down on one knee and asked Vanessa to marry him. "Yes, yes, yes," she said gamely for the cameras, though she would later admit that Don Jr. had proposed to her a couple of months earlier in their apartment. Perhaps the Times was right when it said she was born to be a Trump. The day after the proposal, the Post headlined its story, "Trump Jr. is the cheapest gazillionaire. Airhead proposes with free 100G ring, calling it what has to be one of the cheesiest wedding proposals on record." Donald was not happy with the reviews. A few weeks later, he told Larry King on CNN that he wasn't thrilled with the way his son went about it. "I certainly don't like it with respect to a wedding ring," he said, without mentioning his own most recent wedding ring discount. "I said, you have a big obligation. You have a name that's hot as a pistol. You have to be very careful with things like this." When it came to the wedding, Don and Vanessa again stepped close to the model Donald and Melania set for them. They chose Mar-a-Lago, where his father and stepmother had had their reception that January, setting a date in November 2005. As they registered at Bloomingdale's and Barney's and, of course, Tiffany's, they began to quietly shop around the exclusive rights to photos and footage of their big day, just as Donald had with Getty and Melania with Vogue. Vanessa didn't hire a wedding planner, telling OK Magazine that she'd spent thousands of dollars on bridal magazines as her soon-to-be stepmother had months earlier. She threw her bachelorette party in Miami, for which Ivanka flew down to join her at the then It Club mansion in South Beach. A week before the nuptials, Hurricane Rita hit Florida, knocking out Mar-a-Lago's power for days. There was no water, either. The estate's front lawn, where the ceremony was set to take place, was ravaged by the storm. "We were going to have the wedding by candlelight," Donald told the Post. But the power came back on, as did the water, just in time for the rehearsal dinner on the Friday evening before. The couple hosted their guests for a luau, complete with a roast pig, martini bar, and a DJ Vanessa had heard at her cousin's wedding in New Jersey. On Saturday, November 12th, 370 guests gathered at Mar-a-Lago to watch the eldest Trump heir say, "I do." The crowd was hardly the litany of celebrities who'd gathered for Donald and Melania's ceremony earlier that year. Joan Collins, songwriter Denise Rich, and reality TV starlet Brittany Gastineau took their seats poolside, where the couple decided to move the ceremony after Rita tore up the lawn. Donald, in a tuxedo, walked down the aisle with Melania in a champagne strapless gown flowing out from an ampere waist that barely concealed her growing baby bump. Baron would be born 4 months later. Ivana, in a peach satin off-the-shoulder gown that showed off a diamond necklace with honking pastel stones and fell into bell sleeves covered in ornate silk flowers, left a seat between herself and her ex-husband after depositing her son at his place by the altar, underneath an arch of white and violet flowers. Her mother, Bobby, in a bubblegum pink dress of her own, filled the spot between them. Don Jr.'s hair was nearly long enough to reach his honking silver bow tie. He slicked it back on top and tucked his locks behind his ears, a mix of California Surfer Boy and Rachel Green from Friends. His brother Eric, in a darker gray yet equally wide bow tie, stood by his side as, one by one, all 10 of Vanessa's bridesmaids, including Ivanka, made their way down the aisle in their silk-pale orchid gowns, cut into deep V-necks. Several flower girls in fluffy white confections followed. Tiffany was not in the wedding party. Vanessa's mother walked her down the aisle as her father had passed away years earlier. The bride worked with Reem Akra to design her gown, bright white and skin-tight and heavily beaded on its straps and bodice. For the ceremony, a veil puffed out from the bedazzled tiara she wore atop her flowing loose curls, disguising just how low the back of her dress was cut. She carried a white bouquet filled with calla lilies and little roses, and around her neck she wore a diamond cross. The New Jersey DJ from the night earlier was also a band leader who'd set up a 10-piece orchestra for the ceremony and a 16-piece band for the reception. He charged the couple $20,000 for the evening, more than double what he typically commanded. They played a cover of Bryan Adams' Heaven for the couple's first dance inside the grand ballroom, where guests were served filet and a towering cake by Sylvia Weinstock, the same famed baker who'd created the masterpieces for Donald's weddings. This one was covered in red and pink flowers handcrafted from sugar and fondant. Vanessa surprised Don Jr. with a groom's cake in the shape of a fish, an outdoorsman's delight. The groom teared up when he toasted his bride, recalling that it was his father who'd set him up in the first place. "That's the kind of girl you should be with," he told his guests, his father urged him. The guests noted among themselves that she was exactly the kind of girl Donald himself would have been with had Melania not been in the picture at the time. Donald toasted the couple as well, as did Ivana, who joked that the couple's future children would have to refer to her as Glamma. Ivana did not have to wait long to get her wish. 2 days after their first wedding anniversary, Don and Vanessa invited a group of their closest friends and some family to their apartment. They made another round of toasts to celebrate not just their first year of marital bliss, but also the next milestone. That spring, the couple would become parents for the first time. They shared the news publicly a night later at a party at the 460 Degrees Gallery on Fifth Avenue, at which Vanessa was feted for appearing on the cover of Hamptons magazine, despite the fact that the couple preferred to not go to the Hamptons, especially in season. Don Jr. would sometimes go to Montauk to fish once the rest of Manhattan had left their second homes on Long Island in the fall. Baron Trump, Don Jr.'s littlest brother, was 8 months old. By that spring, he'd be his baby's uncle. "They'll be more like brothers or brother and sister," Vanessa joked to the press. Baron's sister-niece arrived on May 12, 2007. On the evening of the 11th, Vanessa made her way out to a charity event in the city, walked the red carpet with her swelling belly, and walked inside in time for her water to break at her feet. She labored for 21 hours, with Don Jr. there for most of them. When Kai Madison Trump arrived at 6 pounds, 14 ounces, the couple named her after Vanessa's father. But she got something of Donald's. "Everyone who sees her is amazed by her hair," Vanessa told People magazine, which got the exclusive first photos of Kai as the magazine had with Baron, and published them a month after she was born. She needed it shampooed right away. Years later, Kai and Baron would start at the same Upper East Side preschool together, only a year apart. In the winter of 2009, Donald J. Trump III, D3 as he came to be known, was born. Tristan Milos Trump, his middle name after Don Jr.'s beloved Dedo, followed on October 2011. Then came Spencer Frederick, his middle name after Don's other grandfather, exactly a year after Tristan. In June 2014, Chloe Sophia joined her sister and brothers. Hashtag full house, Don Jr. tweeted after she arrived. He, like his father and like his father's father, had 5 kids, 3 boys and 2 girls. By 2017, it became clear that he would follow his father in another way. Vanessa did not accompany Don Jr. and the rest of his family to the New Year's Eve party at Mar-a-Lago, which happened to be her husband's 40th birthday. Tongues started wagging in their small circle, where talk was mostly not if they would separate, but when. Most believed they would stick it out through the 2020 election if they got that far, but Trump history repeated itself. Page Six reported that they were headed for divorce in March of 2018. A day later, Vanessa filed for divorce in Manhattan Supreme Court. "After 12 years of marriage, we have decided to go our separate ways," the couple said in a statement. "We will always have tremendous respect for each other and our families." It took about a minute for rumors of Don Jr.'s infidelities to whip around the press, along with stories of how his tight-waddedness and attack dog nature irked her. The very behavior he spent years freezing his father out over, now people were claiming he repeated. Five kids like his father, with only one woman and no full-time nanny, let alone two. Mothers remember Vanessa as particularly harried, with kids in a constant swirl, particularly as the kids got older and there were five individual schedules to manage. It became a thing of legend among private school moms, who told and retold one cautionary tale of a life with so many kids and so little help. It was warm enough outside that moms and nannies and assorted guardians could pleasantly stand outside Spence, an all-girls school on the easternmost block of 91st Street, waiting for their little girls in their little baby blue jumpers and pleated skirts and white-collared shirts and hair ribbons to burst out of the schoolhouse doors in their sing-songy, chattery post-school delight. When they all burst out at once, though, the noise that came blaring out was very different. It sounded like a high-pitched siren, the school's fire alarm system. "That's weird," the moms and nannies and assorted guardians thought and said to one another. Why would they do a fire drill that late in the day as all the kids were being dismissed? It was not, in fact, a drill. As Vanessa Trump and a couple of her younger boys showed up to Spence to pick up their eldest, Kai, who'd started at Spence in kindergarten, Vanessa started chit-chatting outside. One of the boys ran into the school without her knowing and pulled the handle on the bright red fire alarm hanging on the wall just inside the school's entrance. "You've got to be kidding me," one of the other moms remembered thinking. Her daughter, who was in Kai's class, was terrified of loud noises at the time. This woman had so many kids, you had to feel for her, and there was no nanny. But she couldn't keep enough of an eye on the boys to stop them from disrupting the whole entire school as all the other mothers and people picked up their kids. It was chaos, absolute chaos. Not long after, the school started a campaign to raise money, as uptown private schools so often do, and Don Jr.'s inherited stinginess started to show. At the time, Spence decided to build a brand new athletic center to keep all of its sports programs within one building. At that point, students had to bounce around in a handful of gyms around the city for their various in-school and after-school sports programs, not exactly a draw for the crowds shelling out $50,000 a year for their daughters' elementary school educations. At the very least, that should buy their girls a proper gym. But if you're going to do it at all, why not do it the right way? And the right way for Spence was to build an 8-story facility on 90th Street, with a hulking gymnasium taking up 2 floors, training and locker rooms, squash courts, classrooms, a cafe, and a greenhouse. $50,000 per pupil is a lot of money, but it does not stretch as far as an 8-story fitness megaplex on the Upper East Side. Lucky for the school, they happened to have a Rolodex of already committed families who not only had the money to afford the school, but the incentive to fork that money over. It was going to their own kids' education after all, and maybe their kids' kids after that. Add a little friendly parental competition within the classes over which family would give most, they'd raise the funds, no problem. But there is a process for this sort of thing. The school began methodically hosting a series of small dinners, asking some of the wealthiest parents to host other particularly wealthy parents along with the heads of the school to talk about the plans and about how they could contribute. Don Jr. and Vanessa made the cut for one of the dinners, held in a sweeping apartment on Fifth Avenue one evening when Kai was in her first few years at Spence. Four couples, along with the head of the school and her assistant, ate around a round table in the dining room before they moved into a living room to discuss the gym. A presentation was made along